The rapid spread of Ahmadiyyism and its millions of present disciples testify to the genius of Buddhist ideology to reduce religious precepts to a minimum and yet evoke great dedication from the masses. Dubbed the easy way by its critics, easy. All you need, just have faith, whatever that means, pronounce this phrase or its equivalent often enough, and frankly, do as you please. Any Ahmadiyyist, Buddhist, could buy Augustine's phrase, love and do as you please, minus, of course, the genius and the depth of Augustine. And just this morning I read in a very fine Catholic author, whom I will not identify, just about the same thing, except there were pages of quotation from the Old Testament, pages of quotation from the New Testament, but in substance, that's all you need to be saved. Sisters, believe me, this is immensely helpful to see that human nature is always prone to the easy way. It's not only geometrically that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, or that everything seeks the path of least resistance. It's also human nature. This Ahmadiyyism has the largest number of Buddhist followers in Japan, and in fact is to be found all over the Far East, even outside the ranks of Buddhism. Its doctrines could be understood by the common people. What's there to understand? And its requirements were ultimately only an expression of confident faith, not necessarily continent, in the Buddha Amida. In contrast to the intricate doctrine and practice of the sects, for example, the Zen, it asked little of its followers. Its teachings on hell and paradise became deeply rooted in the minds of devout people and favorite themes for children's stories. For almost 1,000 years, Ahmadiyyism has affected the daily life of countless Orientals and provided them with ideals that are absent or obscured in other Buddhist forms. Pathos, pessimism, generosity, the suicide of young lovers for the sake of a happy married life in another world, the restraint on vice and motivation to virtue because of eternal wars and rewards and sanctions, all these reflect the power of an ostensibly monastic religion to become laicized and flourish outside the cloister, provided it is made easy enough. I'll say just a few words about worship and ritual, and then end with a brief observation about Buddhism for the future. Not surprisingly, given this variety of Buddhist faith, especially in the easygoing Mahayana sects, Buddhist worship would be correspondingly variegated, with the differences arising as between the northern and the southern, depending on the degree in which other religious systems have been incorporated. A fine book, I forget the author now, I may have it in your bibliography, there may be a copy downstairs in your library, published by Sheaton Ward some time ago, Christianity in Japan. Very revealing about the impact of Christianity on Japanese Buddhism. As regards the concepts of prayer and sacrifice, and you'll just have to syncopate here because this is a religion, and you don't dispose of a religion in 3 days. There is no single consistent notion of prayer or sacrifice in Buddhism. Couldn't be. In strict fidelity to Gautama, the Buddhist should not pray to a deity or invoke the assistance of higher powers in the spiritual world. Why not? Because, as far as Buddha was concerned, religion is extra, non-theistic. Many Buddhists, especially among the strict Hinayanists and among the intelligentsia in all schools, firmly adhere to this principle. They do not pray. Pray in the sense, and I hope you carry at least this away from these short 2 weeks. Prayer is the recognition of transcendent being and man's recognition that he depends upon that transcendence, and therefore looking back or looking at that transcendence, looking at it, he adores. Looking back at the gifts he received, he thanks. Comparing the demands of that transcendent being and his own infidelity, he is sorry. Looking forward to the future, knowing that just as his past depends entirely on that transcendent being, so his future, he asks. And that's all, well, that's plenty that there is to prayer. But notice at the heart of it is the recognition of one's own contingency, which the modern world is doing so much to obscure, because man seems, and what a delusion, seems to be so independent, so much master of the forces of the world. At any rate, recognizing his contingency and the non-contingency, the transcendence of the one whom he calls God, that's all he's got to do, is recognize it. And a person who does not recognize it will not pray. Now the Buddhist, therefore, since at the heart of Orthodox Buddhism, transcendence is not part of their system, they do not pray. However, be it said, they are the smallest minority, because most Buddhists are not of the Hinayanist, and less still, of the non-theistic type. And this should be shouted from the housetops. I don't know of a single modern author who is not a Catholic or not a Christian who writes about Buddhism who does not attribute non-theism, as he says, to all Buddhism. That is simply not true. It's as though a person read Dewey, Huxley, Freud, and Feuerbach and said Christians are atheists. How silly can you get? When they pray, this is this type. They pray because of the good effects. Now notice what prayer means then. Because of the good effects which the act of prayer. But of course, you better put it in italics if you're going to talk about prayer in this way, which it produces in one's own mind and character. This is psychological monologue. A monk in Rangoon was quoted, or better, I am quoting him, who said, "Prayer and offering are not received by the Buddha," prayer being the recognition of one's contingency with relationship to transcendence, an offering, of course, being our own, what we call sacrifice. In fact, sacrifice is just a form of prayer. It's just an extension of one's own recognition of contingency in the presence of transcendence. Prayer, he says, and offering are not received by the Buddha in the sense that they have any effect upon him, nor in the sense of being means of procuring anything from him. Their value is subjective purely. If only we knew more of this, because see, these are the charges. I'm not telling you anything new. And these are the problems that Christians, Catholics, priests, God spare the church, and religious, see, who are beginning to think along these lines and asking themselves, what am I doing when I pray except talking to myself? Psychological uplift. Nothing new about that. That's over 2,000 years old. That's Orthodox Buddhism. Pardon the parenthesis. We continue with the quote. Their value is subjective purely. A prayer for peace or purity is likely to bring out its own fulfillment, especially if accompanied by the thought of the Buddha as our ideal. The Buddha, indeed, is, for practical purposes, quite dead. But he is the ideal of what humanity might be, and of what each of us ought to be. Thus, prayer for the enlightened Buddhist is not supplication, but mental discipline. Let me repeat this. Prayer for the enlightened Buddhist, and may I suggest, for some enlightened Christians, is not supplication, but mental discipline. Unquote. The Christian is not in the text. That's my gloss on the text. Parallel with this idea is a basic skepticism about the value of rites and ceremonies. I want to make sure that we don't, when we see and we hear about all these shrines and temples, and they have them, that we keep always in mind that this is the masses of the people, but authentic, orthodox, inner Buddhism, if it practices it, and it may well practice it, as a person can go through all sorts of yoga gestures. But notice the purpose is mental discipline. It is not the recognition of a chasm between two worlds, the empirical and the infinite, which is prayer as Judeo-Christianity understands it, and then it being the bridge between those two worlds. Parallel with this idea, therefore, is skepticism about the rites and ceremonies. Again, from the vantage point of these enlightened Buddhists, the man is early told in the monastery to free himself, first from the general delusion that correct outward action will ensure a man's salvation, and then from the particular delusion that religious rites and ceremonies have intrinsic value to the intended devotee. In a word, nothing will avail as substitute for self-liberation. Gautama was emphatic on this point. In any text of his that I have read, he insists. Buddhas only point out the way. Work out your own salvation with diligence. For the educated, and therefore for the orthodox Buddhist, his religion is above all others a philosophy of individual effort, wherein no one, man or God, should stand for good or evil between a cause and its effect, whether in the practice of virtue or the attainment of nirvana. Is this familiar? You read 10 pages, you read 1,000 pages of Tillich, and accept that he periodically brings in John, or as he prefers, Paul, or Isaiah, or one of the ancient prophets. This is the kind of thinking. Perhaps as a reaction to this practical atheism, or better, non-theism, a large segment of the ordinary Buddhist faithful has gone to the opposite extreme. Not only are petitions to the Buddhas and higher beings, the Bodhisattvas, salutary, but their mechanical repetition or even written inscription carry an efficacy that is simply magical. And this again is one of my insights that I have got. religion tends to polarize people, sometimes within the same culture, one extreme to the other, from non-theism or even practical atheism to a most bizarre kind of fetishism. Bodhisattvas, by all that I've been able to read, are as deserving of worship as the Buddha himself. Indeed, I quote one man, one authority who says, from the Buddha arise only the disciples, that is, from the Buddha who lived back in the early pre-Christian times. But from a bodhisattva, the Buddha, the perfect Buddha himself, is born. In other words, they think of two kinds of Buddha. One who originated, a historical person who had his disciples, who may be said to have been nothing but a human being, and the Buddha of the future, towards whom the bodhisattvas are tending. And then, of course, we have a variety of philosophies, whether it means that all will somehow finally become one cosmic Buddha, or whether the deity is, as it were, in the process of formation and development through the practice of this extravagant charity on the part of Buddhist bodhisattvas, especially in their between earthly and nirvanic existence. With the development of celestial beings came the multiplication of mythical Buddhas. This was due mainly to the familiar Buddhist tendency to stress the spiritual and symbolic side of their founder, while belittling the importance of his actual physical existence. Gradually, the historical Buddha faded away, leaving the Buddha as an expression of Dharma as the only reality. In the Diamond Sutra, the second great Buddhist piece of writing outside of the original scriptures, occurs the famous statement in which the Buddha warns against confusing him with the man Buddha who lived on earth. I quote, "Those who saw me in physical form and followed the voice they heard were misguided in their efforts and will never see me where me is this invisible Brahman, if you wish, by Hindu standards, who is the true absolute, which the original Buddha was not." Now, without denying the historical Buddha, and many don't, not only Mahayana, but all forms of Buddhism see in him only the manifestation of a type. And in this, comparative religionists do Christians a terrible injustice by picking up, as I've mentioned now several times, incidental similarities between, for example, the origin of Christ as found particularly in Luke, the circumstances surrounding his conception and birth, and especially, say, the Ataka tales describing the beginnings of the Buddha, dating from the Middle Ages, certainly deeply influenced by Christian writings, and overlook, ignore, or simply don't state the fact that the Buddha simply does not have the position that Christ has in Christianity. In other words, Buddha is, for most Buddhists, even for the Mahayanists, symbolic rather than historical. In fact, there are so many Buddhas, not only in Hinayana, but in Mahayana, the popular Buddhism, that their number is past counting, who fill the heavens. They are no longer bodhisattvas, but bodhisattvas who have reached Buddhahood, because provided a person has made the discovery and that's it, once he is so enlightened, having reached that nirvanic goal, he is the Buddha. It also enabled, by the way, Buddhist missionaries to prepare the way for the acceptance by other religions, and as Christians we'd like to say, of other religions. With the help of numerous bodhisattvas and Buddhas, polytheism, belief in demons, and all sorts of non-Buddhist ideas came to be and have been assimilated to Buddhism. The gods and demons of other peoples were declared to be the incarnations or the duplications of the Buddhist pantheon. And the best known in the United States is the Baha'is, who began as Muslims but have since pretty well borrowed much of Mahayana Buddhism. Let's pause for a moment and see how this contrasts with Hinduism. In fact, the more I study religious history, especially when I have, as in this case, well, about 2,500 years to work with, or with Hinduism, close to 4,000, or as in the case of the ancient Egyptian religions, and that, by the way, the literature is accumulating, we have texts, 4,700 B.C., among the Egyptians. You add 1900 to that, that's a long span. The more you read of that, and it's healthy, and this is one of the great side benefits of studying comparative religion, you see an ebb and flow. The Hegelian synthesis, the give and take, the concentration on one side or one aspect, then sometimes a revolutionary reaction to the contrary, then some kind of middle ground, then again extremes, then a reaction, then the middle ground, then extremes. If there is anything that could characterize Hinduism, it would be passivity. If there is anything which characterizes this kind of non-Mahayana religion, it is activity. If bodhisattvas, I'm not misunderstood. What I am saying is that while the Buddha reacted in his own way, and there are reactions in already authentic, original, orthodox Buddhism, strong reactions to Hinduism. Nevertheless, he did not react as completely as later on, because what he did was to create an esoteric group, a kind of monastic Hinduism. It took about 4 centuries for the full implications of Buddhism to hit the Oriental world. Mahayana, then, is a reaction against ancient Hinduism. If bodhisattvas are a peculiar creation of Mahayana Buddhism, they are also its most distinctive feature. As a consequence, the whole center of gravity of Buddhist doctrine was shifted from preoccupation with self to the opposite extreme, and the word extreme is correct. Mahayana's writings, now here, of course, is where we are at the mercy of our sources, all of which emanate from the post-Christian era. And therefore, and this must be said, we don't know to what extent, we are sure to some extent, we don't know to what extent Christianity influenced these writings. They are filled with legends, is a mild word, of bodhisattva generosity. An author from the 7th century, and that's about as early as we can get with authenticated Mahayanist writings. That's A.D., of course. An author from the 7th century speaks, I quote, of an insatiable tendency, an enormous tendency, an uninhibited tendency, the tendency towards the good. The bodhisattva would like at every moment to create world levels as numerous as the sands of the Ganges, all filled with jewels, so as to be able to give them away. Not only are the bodhisattvas generous to an extreme, but their assistance is indispensable, no Buddhist can live without bodhisattvas, and invoking their aid, all-powerful. No executioner can slay, no chains hold, no demon or monster will hurt anyone who calls on their names. Now in time, as in Japan, this went completely to seed, where people, as I am told by our men from Japan, and I've taught men from Japan who tell me, that for upwards of 100 years, maybe not quite that long, in spite of a lot of external religion in Japan, it had become the most secularized nation in the Orient. And it became such because about all you had to do to be a good Buddhist was to periodically invoke one of these gods. Sins were forgiven. A whole past man's past lifetime, when he was dying, a simple pronunciation of the name of one of these bodhisattvas, and presto, he reached his destiny. In other words, the unrealism, which, by the way, should also teach us something. Now something about the ideals of charity. I refer to this in your notes. Let me expand somewhat. As might be expected, given this concept of the bodhisattvas, whom people on earth can invoke, who in turn can be so lavish in what they give to others, there would be a change, and there was, in Mahayana ethics. Now, Buddha did speak about kindness. Nevertheless, from all we can gather, it was a cold, dispassionate kind of charity, introspective, and having been a Hindu, self-centered. But now charity was commended towards man and beast to a degree that shocks the Western world. I don't know how much I've, practically nothing I have in your notes on this. It may be so edifying, if read out of context, as to make, and I have seen comparative religionists compare invidiously Buddhist charity with Christian charity and ask themselves, well now, no question which is superior. Well, this is true. Buddhist charity is more extreme. Our Jesuit, Danielu, who has done the most work in this, in fact, among the men who inspired me to get into this, was Danielu. Now, he himself remains, of course, a Christian scholar. His life work for almost 20 years now has been examining the early Eastern patristic writings among the Christians, that is, to see how each influenced the other, opening up scholarship that will be developed in the years to come. He describes this as the fantasy of Buddhist altruism. You may have heard this story. It's classic. If you haven't, it's worth hearing. If you have, worth repeating. There is the story of a monk who had accumulated merits by being faithful to a vow of chastity for 40,000 years. 40,000 is the figure. You see, they don't think in terms of short lifespans. And yet, out of charity, he yielded to his seduction to please a licentious woman, although by so doing, he lost the merit and earned only Mahayana hell. It's a commentary on St. Paul. For my brethren, I would become anathema, but we know that is a contrary to fact subjunctive in Paul. Or again, there's a case of a prince, this is classic, who met a tigress that was dying of hunger with her little ones. Immediately, a burst of charity on his part. He wanted to be devoured by this tigress. But notice, she was dying of hunger, so she was weak. The tigress, therefore, lacked the strength to devour him, so he couldn't practice the charity that he was burning to practice. So he somehow managed to gash himself on some sharp thorn in the forest. Blood began to flow. He placed his bleeding hand to the tongue of the tigress, who had strength enough to lick the blood. By licking the blood, she strengthened herself sufficiently to devour him. Simple folk for over 2,000 years have been instructed by such parables. But the altruism was intended also for the more cultured. Mahayana writers, especially in the early Middle Ages of the Christian era, and here we are sure there is a heavy influence, especially from Nestorian Christianity in China. At any rate, they make charity the principal theme of their discourses. Addressed to the earthly bodhisattvas, people, in other words, and this is another concept, people who have not yet, quotes, died, but have reached that stage where they are living, you might say, saintly lives comparable to those who are bodhisattvas of a heavenly type, who want to imitate their heavenly patrons. In other words, and this bears underlining, because this has affected millions, the concept, therefore, of Mahayana Buddhism is the stress on the imitation of bodhisattvas who have already attained to some kind of intermediary state between earth and nirvana, which, for want of a better word, we can call a temporary heaven. However, there are people on earth, and the ideal is that people should begin to become more and more bodhisattva-like in their practice of charity. Now the significance. There is no need to teach such people a great number of rules. There is one rule which includes them all. When and simply because a bodhisattva is full of compassion, he fulfills, and we are speaking here of the earthly bodhisattva, if you wish, the mortal saint. As long as he is full of compassion, he fulfills all the conditions required for Buddhahood. Just, and the writers use the terminology, as all the senses function in the person in whom life is active.
This concludes Father Hardin's talks on Buddhism. On the next tape, Father speaks on the subject, Basic Principles of Islam.